Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A year ago today, an offshore explosion at the Macondo Well in the Gulf of Mexico became an epic environmental disaster that President Obama vowed never to let happen again. But while questions remain about whether the wetlands and coastal economy will ever fully recover, and if the safety questions at the heart of the explosion have been fully addressed, new drilling permits are being issued. This hour on Point, the BP oil spill 1 year on and the future of offshore drilling. You can join the conversation. Have you been down to the Gulf since the spill? What have you seen? If you were in the Gulf, would you be eating the fish, swimming in the water? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New Orleans is Aaron Viles, Deputy Director of the Gulf Restoration Network, an organization working to protect and restore nature in the Gulf. We spoke with him frequently during our coverage of the spill last year. Aaron, it's great to have you back.
Hello, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'll ask you straight up. 1 year after the BP spill, is the Gulf on the path to recovery?
I think it's far too early to say that. What we do know is it's been 365 days since the Macondo well blew out. But it's been 277 days since the oil stopped flowing. This is something where the oil showed up really a month plus later, and we know that that oil is going to be there. It's still there now. I was there 2 days ago and saw the oil in the marsh with my own eyes. And I think that we've got a long way to go before we can really clean up this Gulf, certainly before we can restore this Gulf, or even before the scientists can tell us what are the impacts really. There's a lot of questions and concerns, but I'm worried there's a lot of people rushing to say that there's nothing to see here, folks. Let's go ahead and move on and let's get back to business as usual.
You say there's oil still in the marsh. Are tar balls still washing up?
Absolutely. And we expect that tar balls will continue to wash up for years, certainly. We know post Exxon Valdez, 20 plus years later, you can still dig into the substrate and find oil. We know that our marsh will hold on to this oil for quite some time. We know that the tar balls that are coming from tar mats that are just offshore, when the weather systems come through, they're going to kick those loose and we'll see the oil redistributed and put on the coast, certainly with less frequency and less volume. But it's happening. It will continue to happen.
What sort of impact are you seeing a year later on wildlife?
Well, we're really troubled. I think the initial body counts weren't as high as some people feared, although with an ecosystem this large, we know that the number of more kind of dead wildlife will actually be able to recover will be pretty small compared to what's actually out there. But right now we're seeing some very odd signs, troubling signs. We're seeing a 10% I'm sorry, 10 times the average rates of newborn or stillborn dolphins washing up in the BP impact zone. These are dolphins that would actually have been pregnant because their gestation period's a year plus. They would have been pregnant when the oil was out there, and now we're seeing a very troubling spike in that type of infant mortality. We're also seeing a spike in turtles washing up, most specifically the Kemp's Ridley, which is the most endangered sea turtle. And then actually just recently an LSU professor was talking about some issues he'd seen with red snapper, which is a deep water species. So it was out in the area most hard hit by BP's oil. And he's seen lesions, bacterial infections, enlarged internal organs that are consistent with an exposure to toxins. So we're really concerned that we're just at the tip of the iceberg here. We're seeing some troubling signs. And at the same time, people are trying to say, oh, it's all fine. We're good to go down here.
You mentioned the snapper. Let me play a clip from last Monday where Karen Hopkins, bookkeeper for the Dean Blanchard Seafood Company, which is the Gulf's largest shrimp processor, told the CBS Evening News that even she is leery of the seafood in the Gulf Coast.
They don't look the same. They don't smell the same. I won't eat it. I won't feed it to my family. And I recommend, that no one eats it.
Although most fish has been declared safe, has it not, Aaron, by the FDA?
It has. The FDA has done tests. There are some independent tests that are kind of showing some different results, but they're using different ways of actually testing the seafood. So there hasn't been a real answer for a lot of the folks down here who saw the oil in the marsh and who see it still and who see the fisheries and the impacts. So people remain a little bit troubled. I eat the seafood, I'll say that, and I think it tastes great, but there are a lot of concerns here in the community.
What about fishing and tourism and other coastal activities?
Well, I think that we've seen a downward trajectory for the coastal tourism. I think that that's clearly understandable. Who wants to go to an area when there's, you know, the possibility of tarballs washing up? And we know there's been a huge decrease in the commercial fishing businesses. So the charter boat captains have seen a huge drop off in their business. But here's the story that I think there's a tension because we went out to Bay Jimmy 2 days ago, saw the oil, but you do go through, you know, a very large expanse of relatively unimpacted marsh. We have about 40% of the nation's coastal wetlands down here in South Louisiana, wetlands that were built by the Mississippi River. And while we do have, you know, a significant acreage, significant, you know, linear miles of marsh that was oiled, we have so much more marsh than anywhere else in the country, it's hard to get a sense of the scale of it. So at the same time, some people, there are some areas that, you know, were hit hard. There are other areas that are absolutely unimpacted. So, you know, it's clearly a tightrope to walk here, but I do think this is an ecosystem that's very resilient. It's very expansive, but we do know that BP's oil is making our coastal wetlands crisis that we are already experiencing, which is about a football field of coastal wetlands disappearing every 45 minutes due to how we've managed the Mississippi River, how we've let the oil companies dredge canals through our coast. BP's crude oil, where it came up, is certainly making that worse. But this overall ecosystem still is incredibly enormous and has a lot of resiliency inherent to it and a lot of productivity.
I'm curious, Aaron, you're there in New Orleans. How does the public feel generally about getting the oil industry back up and running in the Gulf here a year later?
Well, if you work for the oil industry, you tend to say that you really want it back. If you work for, say, if you're a shrimper, if you're a subsistence fisherman, you want to make sure that this never happens again. And I think the politics here in South Louisiana and actually the entire state has been driven by the oil industry's concerns. So if you actually watch where our politicians are saying, they're talking about how the real tragedy was the moratorium. Well, I think that's ridiculous. I mean, the real tragedy here is the BP's oil and what it's doing to this ecosystem and what it's done to the coastal communities who rely on that ecosystem. We'll get the drilling back. It'll happen. We just need to make sure that we learn the lessons right now, because this is the only opportunity we have to really make changes to keep this from happening again. And what we saw was that deep water drilling was a high wire act without a net. And, you know, it's been 99 days since the Oil Spill Commission issued their recommendations, and we haven't seen action by Congress. Those very sensible, thought-out, you know, principled recommendations, I think really the gold standard of what went wrong, why, and what we need to do to make sure it doesn't happen again, are just languishing, because Congress would rather, you know, make a lot of noise about getting drilling back happening, you know, even though production in the Gulf of Mexico is actually at an all-time high right now. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't shut down production. Mm-hmm. We just shut down the exploratory deep water drilling, which was, of course, the problem.
Aaron Viles is Deputy Director of the Gulf Restoration Network. He joined me from New Orleans. Aaron, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Joining me now from Washington is John Broder, reporter for The New York Times. He's been writing about the revamp of the government agency that oversees offshore drilling. John, thank you for being with us.
Good to be here, Jane.
You hear Aaron Viles talking, not painting a very bright picture environmentally about what's going on. Let me ask you about drilling. In the year since the BP spill, the Obama administration has issued 10 permits for offshore drilling. Where has deep water drilling resumed a year later in the Gulf?
Well, it's in more or less the same areas where it was before, the Mississippi Canyon area, which is a large tract that was leased some 5 or 10 years ago, and is parts of it are only now being drilled and explored. And many of the 10, actually there have been 11, but all but one of those were existing wells that were being worked on a year ago when the moratorium was imposed.
So what about BP itself? Has it been allowed to maintain or increase production on existing wells? Are they exploring new projects?
BP has not gotten any permits to resume work on wells that were halted by the moratorium, nor has it gotten any new permits. I think it does have some in the process, and the government agency that reviews them says that they will be judged by the same exact standards as every other oil company. Mm-hmm. They will have to meet all the new standards, but nothing different. There are some in Congress and elsewhere who demand that BP should be held now to a higher standard, but that's not the way it's going to be done by the government.
President Obama has renamed the agency that is responsible for offshore drilling. So the old, quote, Minerals Management Service is now the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Regulation, and Enforcement.
I'm impressed that you can reel that off.
Thank you.
You
write that down. Get it right.
It's one of the more awkward names, and it, too, is going to be broken up into smaller pieces later this year.
Well, I'm curious, have any real changes been made to that organization structure?
Some very significant changes have been made, and I don't want to minimize them. But the first and most important was dividing the revenue collection arm of the old Minerals Management Service from the leasing oversight and regulation arm of it. It was an inherent built-in conflict of interest that was set up that way when the organization was created in 1982. You know, the same people responsible for assuring safety and environmental compliance were also collecting revenues from these companies, and they had a split mission, and most of the emphasis, both from within the agency and pressure from Congress, was to make sure those revenues were being collected. This was a churning generator of revenue for the U.S. Treasury, second only to the income tax.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the consequences of the BP oil disaster. 1 year ago, an explosion at the Macondo well killed 11 workers and pumped some 5 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. John Broder is with me. He's been reporting for The New York Times on the regulatory changes to offshore drilling. I'd like to play some sound now. At a news conference last May, President Obama vowed to make sure that offshore drilling was safe before continuing to issue permits.
We can't do this stuff if we don't have confidence that we can prevent crises like this from happening again.
And Michael Bromwich, head of the new Bureau of Ocean Energy Regulation and Enforcement, defended his agency on the Rachel Maddow program earlier this month. He said the Bureau made changes aimed at preventing accidents before issuing more offshore drilling permits following the BP spill.
We put in place this past fall a set of new drilling safety rules that imposes for the first time a set of quite substantial requirements on operators who propose to drill both in the Gulf of Mexico and anywhere else. It requires certifications by independent engineers of the drilling process. It requires them to address issues relating to well design, well casing, well cementing, which are all in the category of prevention.
John Broder of The New York Times, do these safety rules address, to your mind, the real issues at the heart of the BP spill? I mean, is offshore drilling safe now, as Mr. Bromwich insists?
Well, the rules are absolutely essential and very long overdue. But as Mr. Bromwich and the president will acknowledge, and the president did in a statement today, that the job is not yet done. The technology to contain a spill of the magnitude and force of the Macondo well blowout still doesn't really exist in a tested form. As you know, it took 87 days to cap that well. And the industry has now come together and created a new containment system. But even they admit it could take 2 to 3 weeks to cap a well, which is, you know, hundreds of millions of gallons, not hundreds of millions of gallons, hundreds of thousands of, right. of gallons or barrels of oil gushing out before they can actually contain it. But more importantly, and over the longer term, what really needs to happen is a change in culture in the regulatory agency. For many years, it has served, not to put too fine a point on it, as a handmaiden to the industry, mm-hmm. helping it achieve its goals and and collecting revenue. And now, over time, it's going to have to change to be basically a tougher cop on the beat. And Mr. Bromwich has been out in recent weeks recruiting new people, and it's going to take a decade or longer to really get the forces in place.
Well, I was going to ask you about that change in culture, because there were so many allegations of the flaws in federal oversight and, frankly, the cozy relationship between the oil industry and its regulators in the Interior Department. So you say that that will take time. That's not yet happened.
That has not yet happened. Mr. Bromwich is working hard both to secure the funding that he's going to need for it and to recruit the talent. And it's an uphill struggle because the oil industry can pay so much more.
Let me get a call in here, John Broder, from Omaha, Nebraska. David is on the line. Hi, David. Welcome to the conversation.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
You're
doing a great job filling in for Tom there. I just wanted to say you had made the statement right before you went off the air the last time that is one major disaster enough to derail what we're doing down there. And I would just pose the question, how many disasters does it take before we as, not just the American people, but we as a global society get behind renewable energy, get behind doing something about not being dependent on fossil fuels. You know, the writing is on the wall. Everybody knows it. I don't care what politicians say, how they want to spin it, or how many people they parade in front of the cameras. It doesn't make any difference to me. I'm in Omaha. I'm a far, far cry from the Gulf, but, you know, it impacts every single one of us, you know, in some way, shape, or form. You might not feel it now, but I guarantee you that my children, my children's children, they will understand. They will look back, and we won't be here to accept responsibility for it, and we will leave them with nothing but questions. And you know, the biggest one being why did we not do something about it when we could have, you know, when we had the chance when all the markers were there.
David, thank you. John Broder, would you respond?
Well, it's a good question, and I can understand his impatience. And if you look in just the last year, we had one of the deadliest mine disasters in this country in 40 years. Just a year ago, and at the Upper Big Branch mine, killed 29 workers. We had the horrible Deepwater Horizon spill, the ongoing crisis of nuclear power in Japan. The conventional sources of energy are dirty. They're dangerous. They're contributing to global warming. They kill thousands of workers and hundreds of thousands of people a year with their emissions. At the moment, however, we don't have replacements at scale. We don't have electric vehicles. The natural gas, which some people think can replace petroleum, at least for trucks, is still not available both technologically for vehicles, and the infrastructure doesn't exist. So it's going to be the work, as I said, about regulation of a generation as we convert to renewable forms of electricity. But it's an urgent task, as David, your caller, said.
John Broder of the New York Times, please hold there in Washington. Let me bring another voice into the conversation. Joining me now from San Antonio, Texas, is David Pritchard. He's a petroleum engineer. He's worked in the industry for 40 years on oil drilling and production worldwide. He's owner of Successful Energy Practices International, a company that focuses on drilling hazards management, and a member of the Deepwater Horizon Study Group at the University of California, Berkeley. David Pritchard, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Jane. You know, before we begin this, given 1 year later, I'd first like to begin with a moment of silence for the 11, their families, and the environment.
Indeed, it's warranted. I appreciate you. Thank you very much, David. Let me ask you about the petroleum industry now, in particular the risk management for deep water drilling. How concerned should we be about the fact that the blowout preventers that are being approved now are much the same as the ones that failed on the Macondo well last April?
You know, I think we always need to be concerned about fail-safe tools and the importance of them. And that includes cap containment. You know, but we also have to remember that BOPs and I call them widgets, are in fact not execution tools, they're fail-safe tools. And my focus rather is hazards management and avoiding how we get there to begin with. I like to say it's not about well control, it's about well control avoidance.
John Broder, how do you answer that question? Let me just, David, throw it back to Mr. Broder. Should we be concerned about those blow-up preventers?
Well, yes, but I agree with Mr. Pritchard that the best equipment in the world will fail if the people operating it don't have an overarching safety management system and goal. The government is trying to impose it, but this is something that really has to come from within industry and from the bottom up. There has to be a safety consciousness and a safety case approach to these hazardous activities. But I agree that the blowout preventer in and of itself is not a fail-safe.
Mr. Pritchard, how has the BP oil spill impacted the culture of the industry? We spoke about it a little bit earlier. Are operators and management trying to create safer work environments to avoid, as you speak of, how we got here in the first place?
Well, you know, it definitely has impacted it. And, of course, I've lived in the industry and I believe in the industry. And one thing I do know about this industry, it does have a tremendous ability to recover, very much can-do attitude. But I also believe that we need to lose some denial in some areas and really focus on some issues that I think are very important around risk management.
What is the biggest area of denial, would you say?
I think that it won't happen again or couldn't happen again. I heard the word confidence a while ago. And in a sense, I think confidence is the worst thing we can do because we do well when we don't become complacent.
I'm curious, you've supervised drilling operations all over the world, and I wonder if you have any thoughts about why offshore drilling accidents are several times higher in the United States than in Canada or Australia, Norway or Britain. I mean, does it come back to that confidence piece? I mean, why do we have so many more of them?
Well, I think there are a lot of issues around that. Number one, I'm not sure that's absolutely a correct statement. Now, of course, I don't have the numbers, the facts and figures to verify it one way or the other. What I do know is that the wells and these complexity levels in the Gulf of Mexico are highly complex. These are not your daddy's wells, and I think that's one of the things the industry needs to recognize. In addition to that, it's been well identified through geoscientists that the Gulf of Mexico geological complex is probably more complex than any other basin in the world. So we have geoscience issues. In addition to some of the other things that go around it, these wells are very deep, they're very high temperature, and that's why it demands risk management. And here's the issue we have to remember. We will never eliminate the risk around these wells. It will never happen here or anywhere else. But the risk can be managed, and I think that's where we need to focus.
So do you worry about another disaster like this coming?
We have to. If we get overconfident, then I think that's where complacency sets in, and risk management, just the very philosophy of risk management, demands that we have to assume it will happen again. That's what keeps us on our toes.
Let's go back to Des Moines, Iowa. Nicholas is on the line. Hi, Nicholas. Welcome to the conversation.
Hi, Gene. A couple of responses to your question for the callers, and that one is, I definitely want to have the choice of going to a BP gas station versus the three other gas stations on a corner. I use the BP station, and I use the BP station because I think for them to be able to do everything they need to do in response to what has occurred, they need the revenue, and therefore I want to support them so they can support the Gulf Coast folks. And then the second thing is, as far as allowing BP to continue with the work that they do and stuff, I believe that nobody other than somebody who's made a critical error and had a critical event like they've had, nobody's going to do a better job in the future moving forward than somebody who's been through what they have just been through. Thank you.
Nicholas, thank you. John Broder, would you respond?
Well, I can't really respond to his choice to patronize BP, but except to make sort of a larger point that the company makes, which is that it does need continued access to the leased areas it has in the Gulf in order to generate the revenue to pay the claims. They need to get back out on the water, they claim, in order to come up with the $20 billion or more to compensate all the people who were hurt by the spill. I don't remember his second point. I'm sorry.
Well, I wanted to actually get to the claims. $20 billion set up by the BP to compensate victims. They've doled out about $3.8 billion to roughly 176,000 claimants. And oil spill victims continue to claim and complain about a slow, cumbersome process. I mean, that moving forward is that's going to take years, John Broder.
Well, of course it is. And, you know, the the opposite of a slow, cumbersome process is a fast and uncareful process. Ken Feinberg, who's the special master for this case, is trying to pay emergency claims quickly, and I think he has, obviously, over 100,000 of them. But there's an awful lot of fraud out there as well. We had a great story in our paper yesterday or the day before talking about how lawyers had taken advantage of non-English-speaking fishermen and shrimpers, many of them Vietnamese, signed them up as clients without their knowledge and skimmed off a substantial portion of whatever settlement that they were due. Feinberg is trying to minimize fraud while getting the money out the door. It's not going to be a pretty process.
Here's Karis from Montpelier, Vermont. Hi, Karis. Welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I want to say that I grew up in Santa Barbara, California, and I was there of the big oil spill of 1962, right off the coast of Santa Barbara. And it was a big spill. It went on and on for days and did a lot of damage. And to this day, it is not cleaned up. My daughter lives there now, and she does not walk on the beach because there's too much oil leaking, because there's over 30 oil, wells out there still mm-hmm. drilling mm-hmm. today. She doesn't swim in the water. She does not walk on the beach. And after that spill, I moved up to Mendocino. I was one of the protesters to keep it out from moving up the coast. And we did stop it, but we could not get them away from Santa Barbara. So they're still drilling. And, I'm just so upset. When I go there, I do not walk on a beach anymore in Santa Barbara. And some people see, oh, how pretty. The lights on those oil wells, they look like Christmas trees. You know, the tourists do not mind them. But, I mean, we were there from the 1880s, and all my family swam there and ate the fish. And I must say, I do not eat fish there either. And it's been all that time since 1962.
Still affecting today. Karis, I appreciate your call. John Broder, where do we stand here? I know you have to leave here on this break. I mean, as far as the cleanup, as far as the drilling and the permits that are still being issued and have yet to be issued and will be issued.
Well, the government, the Obama administration, is under a tremendous amount of political pressure from Republicans in Congress, from the oil industry, from local governors and representatives in the Gulf area to speed up the issuance of permits. They're not going to. They are going to review each one under the new safety guidelines and will issue them in turn. But, you know, the reality is those permits will ultimately be issued. Production will return to where it was a year and a day ago. And hopefully we will have learned a lesson. To refer to your caller about the spill off the California coast, those were the last wells that were drilled off the California coast. There has been essentially a moratorium from Southern California to Northern Washington for 40 years.
And the recommendation to establish the Independent Safety Institute to audit industry operations, much like the nuclear industry did after the disaster at Three Mile Island.
That's in process. The American Petroleum Institute, the industry's largest lobbying group, is setting this thing up. It will be independent of government, and it will have the function of reviewing operations from inside. They have, you know, obviously the best petroleum engineers in the country, and they will monitor practices of their peers.
Monitor and review, but really have teeth?
They will have teeth in the sense of naming and shaming. Companies that are laggards will know who they are. Will the public be fully read into that? I don't know. The Nuclear Power Institute, which is, again, wholly funded and run by the industry, is not subject to open meetings laws, not subject to Freedom of Information Act requests, but they do consider themselves a fairly effective governor of their own practices.
John Broder is a reporter for The New York Times. He joined me today from Washington. John, it's always great to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're discussing the current state of oil drilling and the future of energy 1 year after the BP spill. David Pritchard is with us. He's a registered professional petroleum engineer and a member of the Deepwater Horizons Study Group at the University of California, Berkeley. Also joining me now from New Orleans is Frances Beinecke. She's president of the Natural Resources Defense Council. She was a member of the president's National Oil Spill Commission, and she's traveling in the Gulf this week on the commission's behalf. Frances Beinecke, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. The congressional newspaper The Hill reported yesterday that BP is back to making political contributions to those in Congress, House Majority Leader John Boehner among them, other top Republicans. Let me ask you about these three bills currently moving through the House favorable to the oil industry. Is this influencing regulation?
Well, it certainly could if they pass. I think what's really a problem is that the recommendations that came out of the National Oil Spill Commission that we issued in January have not yet been acted on by Congress. And for Congress to consider legislation that would accelerate drilling in the Gulf, and not only in the Gulf, but off the Atlantic and in the Pacific, without putting in place the safeguards we identified as critical, is a real mistake.
Do you think Congress will be able to make the changes necessary with this sort of ongoing influence?
I think it's very hard. One of the things the commission really found and wrote about in the report was that for 20 years, the industry basically has outgunned the responsible agency, the Interior Department, and really constrained them from doing the job of oversight and enforcement that was necessary. And, you know, we made that very clear that that had to change. I think the Interior Department has begun to make the changes, but they need more resources, they need additional authority, and changes need to happen. And those changes have not happened yet, and yet there is this, you know, continuing drive by the industry to have greater access to our offshore and very productive marine environment.
David Pritchard, how do you respond to that and to this new or ongoing, I guess, effort to influence lawmakers and regulation, as it seems, on Capitol Hill?
You know, I suppose with some disagreement, I think improvement in regulations are important, and I know there's always a political process involved. In some ways, I prefer not to dwell on that. The fact is this is an important industry to our country, to our energy needs. And we have to look at the uncertainties. But I think there's something that has to be remembered. This is a cultural issue. It's a cultural issue both within companies and the regulators. And change does not occur overnight. It is step change. And when we say we move ahead, then that has to be stepwise and evergreen. And my issue is the best way to achieve that is with collaboration between the regulators and the operators, not from a manipulation, collusion, or complacency standpoint, but working together to solve the problem. And I think that's a critical issue within the industry and the regulators.
Frances, do you agree that this collaboration?
Well, actually, I do agree on that. You know, we examined how offshore drilling is done in other countries, particularly in Norway and the UK. In the operations in the North Sea. And those operations actually have a higher standard of safety operations. They use a safety culture. There is more, I'd say, more of a collegial relationship between the industry and the government, not a cozy relationship, but one of, you know, sharing information, sharing best practices, having the best performance possible. And, you know, we found that that was not true in the U.S., and that's something that we really think should happen. Of course, in the United States, we should have the highest level of safety operations, and we need to figure out how to make the changes to get there.
David, do you think that the oil industry is on board with that sort of collaboration, with making that happen? Because I think from what our listeners are saying and many others, I think the perception is maybe otherwise.
Well, you know, I wouldn't necessarily categorize. I think some companies probably much better than others. To me, though, Francis did hit on a key word, and this industry does need more transparency. It needs more cooperation with each other, more leveraging the lessons they learn, and a breakdown of some of the barriers that I think there's a false premise that drives that, and that's the need to compete. There are definitely issues of safety and process safety, and I think that's a really important point. I don't think this industry grasps, nor do the regulators, that there's a distinct difference between safety, personal safety, and process safety. So I think once we begin to look at that and put that into perspective and deal with a higher level of transparency, then I think the improvements that sustain reliability will occur.
Transparency, key point, Francis?
I think it is an absolute key point. I think, you know, what we really strove to do with the commission report was to bring all of the operators, all of the companies up to the same level, to the same safety standard. And, you know, David mentioned before that they operate at different levels. That's not acceptable. You know, here I am in the Gulf, and the focus really is on the 11 people who died. There are people out on those rigs every day, and, you know, it's really a responsibility of government to provide the oversight to ensure that those operations are as safe as possible, and they and every single one of them operates at the highest standard, and that there isn't variation.
Back to the phones. Here's Marcia in Elba, Alabama. Hi, Marcia. Glad you called.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
I worked pipeline for many years. I worked for Blackwell, part of Dick Cheney's companies, and we were put in danger of our lives several times. And I support BP. I buy their gas because if they don't have the money, they can't help the people on the coast. And I also make sure that every seafood that I eat is from the Gulf.
You don't worry about it at all?
No, I don't.
Do you think BP's doing enough 1 year later?
Well, I think they're probably doing the best they can under the conditions. You know, you got to have the money to help the people, and the money's got to be rolling in. And if we don't help BP, then they're not going to be able to help the people on the coast.
All right, Marcia, thank you for your perspective. I'm glad you called. Here's Christine in Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Christine. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, Christine. Are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead, please. I think we're having trouble with the line. Let's try Mel in Charleston, South Carolina. We'll try to get Christine back. Mel, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment that very little public attention has been given to the impact of the Deepwater Horizon blowout on deep-sea ecosystems, and that these are unique in the Gulf of Mexico and are actually known to be sources of animals that provide pretty powerful anti-cancer drugs. And also that a NOAA expedition last November found severe impacts on some of these ecosystems at sites that are close to the wellhead.
It's a good point, Mel, and I'm actually reading a study here that was published in Conservation Letters just last month that suggests that the deep-sea ecosystems, the true impact on them may actually be underestimated. They say the fatality figures based on the number of recovered animal carcasses will not give a true death toll, which may be 50 times higher than believed since most carcasses sink before they are spotted. So you bring up a good point, and I'm glad you called, Mel. Thank you. Let's get back to Christine, if we can, in Iowa City. Are you there, Christine?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was in Fort Walton Beach not too long ago, in fact, last week, and it was a beautiful day. Mm-hmm. You couldn't see any oil, and it was, I think, deceptive picture, as we know that there is a lot of dispersant still put in the sea to make it go away visibly. So studies are really, really important to monitor long-term what's going on. One of the key studies is from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, which would be the most unbiased study. I would not believe anything from the American Petroleum Institute that was mentioned earlier, that is not an independent review board. But this study from the NIEHS was not even funded until 6 months after the spill, wasn't even started. So it makes it very difficult for workers, and it concentrates on workers, for their recall, the recall of their exposures. Secondly, community members are not part of being studied there, and we know the Gulf Coast communities are often affected by other health issues already. Mm. It's very important to study community members. The third thing is that in the focus on the toxicology, it's mostly on benzene. Benzene, as we know, is a carcinogen. However, the polyaromatic hydrocarbons, which are a multitude of what's in oil, are not so well studied and cannot probably be easily studied. but they have bad impacts.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing is the dispersant that was in the press so much heightened unnecessarily concern because BP didn't want to give away what's in it, and EPA quickly examined it, and there was a stool softener in it and another component that causes angiosarcoma in rodents.
A lot in there, Christine, and I'm glad that you brought it up. 4 points there. Francis Beinecke, would you respond?
Well, I think that her points are absolutely right on. If you're down in the Gulf and you talk to people up and down the coast, people are experiencing health impacts. And the NIH study is a long-term study, but people here need health care now. And that's something that really has not been provided to them. So this is an ongoing issue. It's an issue which the commission just had a brief opportunity to look at, but it's an enduring issue. And the dispersant issue is also very important because we've never had used that volume of dispersants or at that depth. And this is where the long-term monitoring programs are very, very important, as the earlier caller mentioned, too, about what the impact is on the deep-sea environment. There is a lot of science that needs to continue to be done. Information will be forthcoming in the coming months and in the coming years. But just because the oil is not spewing out from the Macondo well doesn't mean that the impacts are gone.
You speak of the health impacts. Here's ABC's World News Tonight, and a Gulf Coast fisherman who joined the oil spill cleanup crew just under a year ago. He now says he has health problems that he's never experienced before.
Cough, always coughing. Wake up in the middle of the night coughing.
When you look at him, he's never smoked a day in his life.
I had bronchial pneumonia 4 times. I ain't never had no kind of problems prior.
David Pritchard, what do you make of all that?
Oh, gee, it's a very complex subject. I'm not an environmentalist. I do believe in the environment. I think there's a lot of issues that are very complex. And first, let me say that I imagine every single caller that we've had at some point in time heats or cools their houses or gets in their cars and drives to the doctor. And so, you know, there are also risks with lives, and I'm definitely not downplaying it. But here's where I think the industry can help, and here's where I think we need to be responsible. We need to assume more accountability. I look back, for example, to even the Senate hearings where it just simply became a blame game. We know there are environmental risks. We need to manage those risks. But we also need to assume responsibility and accountability, and I think that's something we could definitely improve, and we owe it to the public to do so.
Let's get another call in from Evan in Panton, Vermont. Hi, Evan. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Thank you.
You bet.
I wanted to bring a different way of looking at how I look at these debates, and I don't see it often articulated, but I wanted to encourage people to look at, like, when they consider the real costs and risks of all this energy exploitation, whether it's oil or coal or natural gas, I don't often see it compared to the relative what we're getting out of it. You know, I'm very critical of our society, and I look around and we have dollar stores and Walmart filled with plastic, junky knickknack, and I see that this is actually what we're converting all of these oil and these energy sources into a worthless consumerist society where we waste so much. And I would say the accountability that this gentleman just spoke of should be put on our society also to stop playing in and buying all this junk that we're ultimately poisoning each other with. This should be part of the energy debate, and the reason that we can't have alternative energy all the time is because it can't meet our demands. Well, someone should be saying our demands are out of proportion to what our supplies are. And when we factor in the real risks of these things, I think we're way too lackadaisical with what we buy and produce and we import and ship around the world.
Evan, thank you. Thanks for the call. Here's another thought from Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Hi, Dale. You're on the program. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
You bet.
I'd just like to wonder where all the sympathy comes from for BP, they need our money to fix the problem, to pay the people down there. I believe they owe the people down there. I believe they owe the world for ruining our Gulf. And I wonder where the sympathy comes from for BP and why it just isn't taken care of. They've got the money.
Dale, thank you. Francis, we've heard that a couple of times from callers this hour.
Well, I think that one of the most important things is that BP has to be held accountable. They have to, the fines that are need to be placed on them from the Clean Water Act damages need to be determined, and the natural resource assessment damages need to be determined. The costs to BP are not yet over, and it's important to hold them accountable, and also it's important to get that money back to the Gulf for restoration of this coastline, which is incredibly productive from an ecological standpoint, but has been degraded consistently over the years because of heavy use from the oil industry. So, you know, I think that BP needs to be held accountable, and the money needs to flow right back here so that it can actually pay for some of the damage that's been done to the literally tens of thousands of people's lives along the coast.
With about a minute left, let me ask both of you, Francis and David, with Japan's nuclear crisis, U.S. troops in Libya, the rising price of oil, do we need deep water drilling to fulfill our energy needs now, moving forward? About 30 seconds for each of you. David, you first.
Well, you know, in reality, I don't think we have any choice. I mean, we need to look at a plethora of energy sources. I think one of the things that we fail to do in all of our endeavors is both in Japan and in the Macondo and in other blowouts that are occurring as we speak, is we look at the risk, but we as an industry sometimes fail to mitigate the entire consequence and fail to even recognize the consequence of what could happen.
And Francis, you get the last word.
Well, we need to move quickly to a clean energy future to minimize the amount of oil that we depend on to be as efficient as possible. That's the only solution in the long run.
Francis Beinecke from New Orleans today, president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, and David Pritchard joining us from San Antonio, Texas, registered professional petroleum engineer. My thanks to both of you. I appreciate your time on this one-year anniversary. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you. You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.